I'll do that. We're going to play it.
Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, that's great. That sounds terrific. Thank you.
Bobby Edmonds, sociology professor, Dr. Zoe Spencer, and Oklahoma criminal attorney, Anthony McKesson. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Tonight we're going to be talking about the trial. Do you believe that Jose Baez and his defense team won, or do you believe the prosecution failed to lay out a timeline and definitively tell us what happened to cause the death of Kaylee Anthony? Did the prosecution fail to tell us the who, the what, the when, the where, and the how of Kaylee's disappearance for 31 days? And did the Anthonys, Cindy, George, Lee, and Casey Anthony all manage to turn the trial into a case of who done it and what done it, therefore confusing the jury, which resulted in Casey being found not guilty. Well, tonight we're going to play the 911 tape, as well as hopefully lay out a timeline to track what happened from the point Kaylee was first reported missing. At this time, I'm going to introduce my panel. But before I do, I want to remind you that the views and opinions of my guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or the host. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you a California bounty hunter, the one who posted the $500,000 bail that first got Casey Anthony out of jail. That's Mr. Leonard Padilla. Also, we have attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds, sociology professor Dr. Zoe Spencer, and Oklahoma criminal attorney Mr. Anthony McKesson. Good evening, everyone. I'm going to open your phone lines. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
This is Leonard Padilla in California. Good evening, folks.
Nay. Do I have Mr. McKesson on the phone? Okay, I've opened somebody's phone line incorrectly then. Do I have Bobby Edmonds on the line?
Yes, on the line.
Okay.
Good evening,
then
everyone.
I'm going to find Dr. Zoe Spencer. Dr. Zoe Spencer, are you on the line?
I'm here. Good evening, Carrie.
Good evening. Okay, you all. So we're going to start with Mr. Padilla. Mr. Padilla, tell us what you believe happened to Kaylee Anthony. What happened to little Kaylee?
Okay, on the night of the 15th of June, Casey returned home, and her mother had been at her father's rest home with the child.
Mm-hmm.
There was a discussion about $320-some that were missing from Cindy's mother's account that Casey had transferred to an AT&T bill in order to keep her phone hooked up.
Mm-hmm.
The argument got very serious, serious enough to where the neighbors could hear the discussion and the fight that ensued, and also the fact that Cindy got so upset that she actually physically grabbed Casey around the neck and was actually choking her. Now, prior to that time, Cindy had been swimming in the pool with her daughter, granddaughter. And as Casey came home, they prepared her for bed. When the fight got so upset, Casey went to her bedroom. The mother was still very upset, and it was like Casey was going to go to bed and everything was cool. But what she did, in fact, was dress her daughter, except for shoes and socks. And as soon as Cindy was asleep, or at least Casey thought she was asleep, she snuck out of the house and got the car. Now, she had a serious problem with Tony Lazzaro, who ran the club. She could not take the child to Lazzaro's residence in the evening, at night. She could take her during the day, as long as she was there and available to watch her, but she could not have her come there at night if Casey intended to sleep over. Therefore, on several occasions prior to this, she had learned how to make chloroform and had put the child to sleep. The reason she learned how to make chloroform is because she no longer had the ability or the financial wherewithal to buy Xanax, which was, according to what I learned back there in 2008, a common situation for putting children to sleep instead of some of the other more common things. But she was broke, had no money, no job, running out of gas constantly, and therefore had turned to chloroform. It had worked several times. There was no problem. We talked to people that were her friends where she actually had the child at parties, and the child would sleep right through the parties.
But you had, she had to make the chloroform, right?
Excuse me?
She had to make the chloroform.
Right, which is really quite simple to make. The chloroform got banned in the United States back in the 70s because it was so dangerous and so volatile.
Mm-hmm.
Children have a way of going around and they smell something and they hold it up to their nose and smell it. One good whiff of chloroform and a child is dead. When I was stationed in Arizona, we used to use it to pump into some holes outside the base to make the rattlesnakes somewhat lethargic. We didn't want to say we were killing them because then we'd have all sorts of problems, but because that kept them from crawling onto the base during the day looking for shade under the aircraft. But in this particular situation, She recognized that at about 2 in the morning after she had given her the chloroform and was getting back in the car, the child was lifeless. She put her in the car seat. She basically felt at that time that she was dead, didn't really know what to do, and drove around till about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, at which time she went to Lazaro's house. This is the morning of the 16th, parked the car at the far end of the parking lot where Lazaro lives. I went up the apartment, spent some time there. They then that evening went and got some movies. She spent the night there. The next morning, she borrowed his Jeep. She didn't want to drive her car because she had the child wrapped in a blanket in the trunk of the car. She borrowed the Jeep on the morning of the 17th, went to the Sawgrass Apartments after she'd been over to see another friend of hers that morning. He was busy helping his mother. She then went to the Sawgrass Apartments where Dante lived. At that time, she saw Zenaida standing by her New York-plated Kia Silver, not a Ford Focus, but a silver Kia. She mistook it as a Ford Focus because her previous boyfriend, Ricardo Morales, owned a Ford Focus, silver in color.
Okay, are we talking about Zenaida, Zanny the Nanny?
Correct, Zanny the Nanny.
Okay.
She pays attention to the fact that this lady's got a couple of kids, goes up to the office. She knows the young gentleman that handles the office during the day, says, hey, who's that lady? She's a lady that's looking to rent an apartment. She's getting divorced. She's got two children. And she actually takes down the information. The next day, she goes back to the house with her child in the trunk of the car, borrows the shovel from the neighbor. Her intention is to bury the child next to the dollhouse in the backyard. The dirt's too hard. She doesn't have the ability to work that hard. So then she decides, okay, I've wrapped the child in a couple of plastic bags and a laundry bag, put tape on the child's mouth. When the child's body is found, it'll be a kidnapping that went wrong or whatever. Puts the child back in the trunk of the car. She drives around until the 24th when her dad's looking for his gas can. The 24th, she panics and does what is commonly referred to in the business as a panic dump. She drives down to the end of the street, makes a right-hand turn at the dead end, into the bushes, gets the child out. By this time in the Florida sun, the child is nothing but 35 pounds of what you might call liquid bones and stew. As she's pulling the body out of the trunk, the bag rips. So now you have horrible decomposition all over her and the car, the trunk. As she turns around and takes a step, she trips over some building blocks that are there, and the body just kind of falls out of her hands and rolls up against what you might call a log or a piece of tree that is laying there. All of this is within 19 feet from the exact edge of the road to where the body ended up laying. If you take the mowing strip, which is a 5-foot wide strip, and take 5-foot width of the car, that takes 10 feet, and take another 5 feet to where she tripped over the blocks, the building blocks, the body was 4 foot inside the building blocks. That's where the body rested from that time, June 24th, until December the 11th, when Quant found the body.
Okay. So that's Mr. Padilla's version of what he thinks happened. Now, my question is, how did you come up with those facts? Or how do you believe that this is what happened?
A lot of the facts came from Casey's own mouth to Tracy, who lived with her for 9 days.
Okay. And Tracy was who? She was the person that was hired by you to watch her because you had posted the bail?
Yes. Tracy has worked for me for many, many, many years. Okay. Tracy's got experience in many areas of the work that we do, which is locating fugitives, locating lost people, and sometimes locating murderers before they've even been charged.
Okay.
So there's a tremendous amount of experience in her. There's a tremendous amount of experience in Rob Nick, who was a deputy sheriff for the Sacramento County Sheriff's Office.
Mm-hmm.
He then came to work for me almost 20 years ago and has probably 4,000 arrests to his credit.
Robert Dick was over security, correct?
He was in charge of security.
Okay. And nephew was the actual...
My nephew, Tony Padilla, is a bail agent in California.
Right. Okay, so he's the one that actually posted the bond.
He's the one that I said, hey, I'll pay you the $50,000 if you'll go to Florida with us and post the bond. He then contacted Al Estes, who works for the same company that he does out of Houston, Texas, and had Al Estes post the bond for him because you have to be licensed in Florida. And he's the one that actually posted the bond when Casey Anthony got out, yes.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, now that's Mr. Padilla's facts about work, or that's what he believes happened. We're going to ask our other two guests what they believe happened. Then we're going to go into the timeline, and we're going to also play the 911 tape tonight because we're going to try to reconstruct what we think happened. We, you know, there's no way of definitively knowing, but Wikipedia has a timeline, and so did CFNews13.com. And so we're going to kind of go back and forth off the timelines that I see on both of those sites, and we're going to kind of try to figure out what we think happened. Because I think what I noticed in this particular trial was I think everybody got confused about the facts. And when I say everyone, I think I'm speaking of the jury. I think they got very confused with all the different scenarios that were thrown out there, and they just said, okay, that poses reasonable doubt, so therefore we can't convict her.
Can I make a statement?
Yes, sir.
Okay, here's one of the problems. Now, let me give you a little background on me, okay?
Okay.
I'm a young guy that went to five different high schools in California, worked in the fields, Mexican families, immigrants. I went in the Air Force when I was 17. I was lucky enough to be bright enough to get picked for a special unit that went to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
We worked in Libya. We worked in Egypt. We worked in all the countries of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I had come out of the military, I knew two things. I knew how to kill and I knew how to think.
Mm.
Now, those are things that, where do you put these items to work that you become real good at? Well, I went to law school under the GI Bill. And under the GI Bill, I went to Lincoln Law School and I got my degree in 1980. Now, 2 years after I graduated, I noticed that there was a lot of Mexican people, folks like myself, couldn't go to law school because they didn't have the money.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky enough to go under GI. So in 1982, I started the University of Northern California Lorenzo Patino Law School, later renamed for a good friend of mine, Judge Patino, who died of leukemia in 1983. So it's the Lorenzo Patino Law School. In this school are individuals that are very street savvy, very street wise, but most of them, I've had to help get GEDs in high school to get them into the paralegal program, to get them into the law school program, to get them past the CLEP, the college level equivalency program.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very bright, and I brag about it, very bright and very intuitive. I know how to think.
Okay.
A lot of people think, well, I know how to think. Everybody knows how to think. No, until a fellow by the name of Lieutenant Barroff took me aside in the Air Force and basically said, I'm going to teach you how to think. I did not realize I didn't know how to think at the time. But one thing I do know is how to think, and I teach all the students and all of the professors that teach at my law school. The first thing you must know about law is how to think. One of the things that happened was Baez, who I consider to be a good friend and a stellar attorney, did not win the case.
Okay.
Ashton lost it.
Okay.
Ashton lost it because he was afraid of certain facts. He didn't want to put the fight with Cindy Anthony into evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Because he thought that would create a question mark about Cindy Anthony, who he wanted to be a witness of his.
Hmm.
He also didn't put George Anthony under the spotlight when he lied about seeing the child leave the house the very next day on the 16th. He didn't see her leave with the child on the 16th because she left the night before. That was a lie. But Cindy and George concocted that because they didn't want to look like anything less than a stellar family. Ashton knew all of these things, but he didn't do anything about the fight, and he didn't call George about him not seeing that child the next day.
Hmm.
He also didn't put Tracy on the stand, who lived with Casey
for nine days after she was released from jail the first time.
9 days, 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
Those two women bonded, and today Tracy has said it a dozen times, if not more than that, except for the fact of what she did. I love that girl.
Wow.
She's like my soul sister.
And you know what? That's one thing that I noticed, that Casey obviously has a very winning personality, because I could tell, and I think I said this to Dr. Zoe Spencer, that it seemed like the defense team really fell in love with her, and she was like, they bonded with her, and they really, you know, worked hard to get her out of this. But we're going to go to Judge Bobby Edmonds. Attorney Edmonds, what do you think happened? You followed the trial. What do you think happened?
I followed the trial, but you definitely really couldn't connect Casey. The way it was presented, there were so many loopholes in connecting the evidence to Casey.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, when you look at trying to see what time period did this child actually die, and of course they tried to use the scientific evidence, but that didn't link any DNA to Casey. the things that Mr. Padillo is saying, those things didn't really come out in court. And, of course, even if the fight with Cindy had come out, it's going to further show that that was a dysfunctional family. And when the parties were testifying, it appears that they weren't as credible as they should have been, particularly mm-hmm. the father. So you see that there, either they were covering up something or there was something within their family that they did not want to be disclosed. So they didn't make very good witnesses, I didn't think, for the prosecution. And a defense attorney only has to prove that there's reasonable doubt to the level where the jurors will say, we have some serious problems here. It doesn't have to be, and it depends on the factual circumstances. So the jurors here did not include all the high publicity out there, because if it was in public opinion, he would have been found guilty. But mm-hmm. I assessed the case before the jury actually rendered the verdict, and I was telling people they're going to find her not guilty on the charges, but they will find her guilty on something less, possibly the misdemeanor. And that's what happened later on that day, because I could not see how, if the jurors did look at all the evidence that was as presented,
mm-hmm.
there were doubts.
Mm-hmm.
There was credibility issues with the father testimony. Mother gets up there and says she did some research on the computer with the chloroform. You have some doubt being built. And that's really all the prosecution had to do. They didn't have to put Casey on the stand. They really didn't have to call a single witness.
Mm-hmm.
But they chose to call witnesses because it was necessary with this high-profile case to call some witnesses at least.
So, okay.
We don't even know now. How did the baby die? How did she? We know there was tape allegedly over her face. We know that chloroform was allegedly involved. I hear Mr. Padilla says that Casey had a practice of putting the baby to sleep with the chloroform.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where did she get this from? Did her mother do that when she was a little child? I don't know. There are so many issues with the family that stem a surface to me. And so
at this point in time,
we really don't know, but we know what was presented in court, and all the judge could do is rule on the issues of law, on the objections. All the defense attorney could do is use what he had, and the strategy of not calling certain witnesses, that was his strategy, good or bad.
Let me see if I can inject something here.
Okay. Yes.
One of the problems that Ashton had, and I'm glad you've got a judge on this show,
mm-hmm.
was that on about the second or the third visit that Baez had with Casey at the jail, the conversation was overheard by one of the investigators in the case. Every time that Baez went to visit Casey, the investigation team was contacted.
Oh.
I think it was the third time.
Yeah, they were eavesdropping.
I think it was about the third time when she related the drowning of the child in the pool and the dad and her making the body down around the corner and placing the body where it was found. She related that to Baez. Law enforcement heard it.
Mm.
Now, law enforcement, as the judge can tell you, had a predicament in their hands.
Yes.
They cannot listen to the conversation, therefore, they cannot do anything other than what do we do? We know where the body is. How do we find the body?
Mm.
The media would
have
torn them
apart. Because it would have been suppressed. That type of evidence would have been suppressed because they violated a right in eavesdrop.
So you're alluding to the fact somebody tipped off the meter reader to where the body was so that he could go and discover the body.
Let me walk it backwards for you.
Okay.
In the latter part of August, when Tim Miller was there, on the 26th or the 27th, I think it was the 27th, the same day that something else happened, he was told by one of the investigators, the lead investigator, I've got you $5,000, don't leave town, because Tim was getting, he was leaving town. He was leaving. He'd gotten in a big row with Cindy over the searching of the body. Cindy said the child's alive. He's saying she's, you know, possibly deceased. Tim was there because my nephew, Tony Padilla, who posted the bond, had contacted Cindy and told her, get a hold of Tim Miller in Texas. All right, Tim's leaving town. This cop comes and says, don't leave, don't leave. I've got you $5,000 from the sheriff's special fund. Go search by the school, which is basically where the body was.
Hmm.
Okay. Tim doesn't find the body. Subsequently, I asked Tim, why didn't you search where the body was? He says, Leonard, it was 4 to 10 feet of water there, which it was. Hurricane Fay had come in there and made that a big pond, a huge pond.
Wait a minute, Tim again is who?
Tim Miller. He runs Equisearch.
Okay, got it.
Out of Texas.
Okay.
He didn't want to lose his equipment. He made a cursory search of that place and other places, including Jay Blanchard, and left town.
Hmm.
Subsequently, there was a situation that arose where, what do we do? How do we find the body without being connected to it?
Hmm.
Well, this one gentleman says, wait a minute, Michelle Carpentier, she's in the detention side of the jail. She works in the jail. Her boyfriend is a meter reader, but he works across town. Now, look up when Roy Kronk was transferred to that area.
So the meter reader did not always work that particular area. He was transferred to that area.
Correct. Now, when he was transferred.
His girlfriend works at the jail.
Yes, okay. Michelle Carpentier worked at the jail. Now, if you form a mental picture of the area where the body was found, when I first heard where the body was found, I remembered that there was a place, but I just couldn't see why a water meter reader would be in that area, because there isn't a single house along there. There's no houses, no water meters, nothing. It's just a stretch of swamp.
So legitimately, he had no reason to be there.
Zero reason to be there.
Wow.
Now, on August the 11th, why is he talking about bones? You've heard the 11th and the 12th and the 13th of August, those phone calls?
Yes.
Why is he talking about bones, a skull?
So you're talking about what the meter reader said to 911?
No, he said it to his dispatch.
Okay, he said it to his, okay, gotcha.
August 11th, 12th, and 13th. Listen to those calls in detail. On the 11th of August, there was no mention by law enforcement of anything publicly that included a body.
Oh.
They were looking for a missing child, period.
Wow.
How did law enforcement then privately know they were looking for a body?
Okay. So he would have had to overhear the conversation to know that it was no longer a missing child, that it was a body.
On the 11th of August.
Wow.
It appears that, so you're indicating that there was a cover-up.
Wait a minute. He talks about what he calls a pool cover. There was a pool cover, a gray pool cover, a striped pool cover. Listen to the calls. That is not a pool cover. It's one of these big umbrella tents with the windows rolled up against the brush. But when you look at it from 30 foot away, it looks like something that might be a pool cover, but it's not. It's an umbrella all rolled up. It's still there. As of 2 weeks ago when I was there, it was still there.
So did Mr. Kronk collect a reward money?
I think he eventually got $15,000 for the picture of the snake, which was not a snake that he picked up. It was a snake that David Dean, there were three meter readers that were there that morning. Not one, three.
Hmm.
Now,
wow.
The snake was picked up by David Dean. Subsequently, there was a big thing about the snake, the snake, the snake. I set about, I figured, okay, I called David Dean, I says, where's the snake? In my freezer. I called the FBI, I told them, the FBI should check that snake. Well, why should we? I says, hey, you know, this is after the body had been found. I says, there's talk about chloroform, maybe the snake stuck its head in the bag and got a whiff of chloroform, who knows? Well, so they went out and served a search warrant and got the snake. They still have the snake in evidence.
Wow.
There were things that came up that Ashton didn't even want to get close to. Remember at one time when Baez or somebody's asking somebody, I think it was Hoover, regarding the pictures that he'd offered to somebody for sale?
Mm-hmm.
That was me he offered them to. After the body was found,
really?
On I think the 13th or the 14th of December, he says, hey, Leonard, you want to buy some pictures? I figured, no, cops are trying to set me up. I don't want no part of it. Finally, he showed them to me, and I said, you better get a hold of Nick Savage with the FBI. He'd be very interested in why you guys were out there on the 14th and 15th of November, exactly 72 feet away from where the body was, which is where Kronk was, exactly 72 feet away on the 11th, 12th, and 13th of August. The reason he was 72 feet away, remember when I told you she stepped out of the car? She had the stuff dripping all over her.
She tripped and fell.
Took two steps and tripped over some building blocks?
Right.
When she's telling Baez that she tripped over the building blocks, that's key. Because if you go 72 feet from where the body was found, there's a stack of building blocks there. But these are in plain sight, right by the edge of the road, in plain sight, not hidden in the grass like the ones she tripped over.
Wow. Y'all, we got so much to get to. We got to get to the 911 tape. We got to put this timeline together. And also,
yes,
we want to hear from Dr. Zoe Spencer. Dr. Zoe Spencer, what do you think happened?
Carrie,
Zoe, did we lose you? Okay, I think we've got a connection problem with Dr. Zoe Spencer.
Carrie, I'm
you
here.
There?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. What do you think happened?
Okay.
What happened to Kaylee Anthony?
You know, I'm listening to Mr. Padillo, and I have to admit that I did not follow the trial as closely as other people followed it, and I really just got in on the tail end of the discussion, and I'm listening to him, and he seems to have a lot of information that was not presented. You know, I could speculate on it because, you know, as we've kind of discussed, I have my own hypothesis. You know, about what happened. One of my concerns is even in listening to the 911 tape, and I know that we're going to get to that at some point, you know, it seems like everybody is regurgitating the things that were presented. Mr. Padillo seems to have some additional information, but it seems like everyone is regurgitating the chain of events that were recorded by Casey's mother and her father. And, you know, I really question whether or not those accounts are true. I really have some serious questions, and I guess I'm the naysayer. Everyone is talking about chloroform. You know, I don't see where chloroform entered the picture. Mr. Padillo made mention about that Casey had used forms of putting Kaylee to sleep before, but I don't remember anybody taking the stand to attest to that. So, you know, I really have questions about whether or not the chain of events as reported by Cindy Anthony and her father are actually accurate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think, and as do a lot of people. You brought
I think
up
that's
the 911 tape. We're going to play it now. And you all decide for yourself, and I'd like to discuss the tape afterwards, because I hear a whole lot in this 911 tape, which I think is, and this is, the voices that you'll hear is Casey Anthony and Cindy Anthony talking to a female 911 operator. And I think this really pretty much sets the stage for how the rest of the investigation went after this. Okay, here we go.
911, what's your emergency? I'm calling a little bit ago. The deputy sheriff said, yeah, I found out my granddaughter has been taken. She has been missing for a month. Her mother finally admitted that she's been missing.
Okay, okay, what is the address that you're calling from?
We're talking about a three-year-old little girl. Oh, my daughter finally admitted that the baby couldn't store. I need to find her.
Your daughter admitted that the baby is where?
The babysitter took her months ago that my daughter's been looking for. I told you my daughter was missing for a month. I just found her today, but I can't find my granddaughter. She just admitted to me that she's been trying to find her herself. There's something wrong. I found my daughter's car today, and it smells like there's been a dead body in the damn car.
Okay, what is the three-year-old's name?
Kaylee. C-A-Y-L-E-E. Anthony.
Kaylee Anthony?
Yes.
Okay, is she white, black, or Hispanic?
She's white.
How long has she been missing for?
I have not seen her since the 7th of June.
What is her date of birth?
2005.
Ma'am. for the last 31 days. And you know who has her?
I know who has her. I've tried to contact her. I actually received a phone call today now from a number that is no longer in service. I did get to my daughter for about a moment, about a minute.
Okay, did you guys call and report a vehicle stolen?
Yes, my mom did.
Okay, so has been a vehicle stolen too?
No, this was my vehicle.
What vehicle was stolen?
It's a 98 Pontiac Sunfire.
Okay, I have deputies on the way to you right now for that. But now your 3-year-old, okay, your 3-year-old daughter is missing. Kaylee Anthony.
Yes.
White female.
Anthony. Yes, white female.
3 years old, 8/9/2005 is her date of birth?
Yes.
And you last saw her a month ago?
31 days. Some 31 days.
Who has her? Do you have a name?
Her name is Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez.
Who is that? Babysitter?
She's been my nanny for about a year and a half, almost 2 years.
Why are you calling now? Why didn't you call 31 days ago?
I've been looking for her and have gone through other resources to try to find her, which was stupid.
Okay. Can you give me the name of the nanny again? Like, spell it out for me.
Zenaida, Zenaida.
Last name?
Fernandez. Hyphen Gonzalez. I think the officers are here.
The officers are there?
Yes.
Okay, hold on a second. Let me know.
Y'all, that was a 911 tape.
Let me jump in here with something.
Okay.
Have you got Kronk's calls from the 11th, 12th, and 13th of August?
Yeah.
Those are the calls that triggered the search for Kaylee as a deceased person.
Okay, so those were the calls from the meter reader.
Correct.
Okay.
Play those.
Kaylee, can I answer?
I don't have those. I had so much trouble getting this today. I did not get those, but we're going to do a part two, and we're going to definitely get the everything. We're going to get the police report.
If you have somebody there that you can spare, you can pull them right off the computer. They're on the computer.
Really?
They're on the computer. You can pull them right off the computer.
Okay, I'm gonna try to get somebody to find that for me. Dr. Zoe, you were trying to say what?
Yeah, I want to interject because, you know, from a sociological or psychosocial perspective, there are a lot of things in the context of that 911 tape that, you know, that are red flags for me. And I like I said, I didn't follow the case completely. You know, much of it is you know, based on kind of my professional intuition, if we can balance the two. But there are a lot of things about that 911 tape that are really, really off balance to me. One of the things that I want to point out that's very strong is that Kaylee knew that the 31 days and the date that her mother gave, that date was very significant, 31 days. And she was very deliberate to make sure that she corrected 31 days.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there was an imbalance in the emotion of the mother, and then almost the detachment that Kaylee came in with. Number two, when the mother starts, she basically rolls Kaylee under the bus by saying that the car smelled of death. Basically, right there, you're implicating your daughter in the murder. Usually when you're getting ready to tattletale on somebody, and this is just natural kind of progressive human dynamics, if you're about to tattletale on somebody or accuse someone of murdering their child, it's not normally something that you would do in the presence of the person that you're accusing. So to me, and this is just my opinion, you know, just based on really nothing really hard, but it seems very, very staged. And I don't know what happened 31 days ago, but to me it's kind of clear that Kaylee died 31 days from that phone call.
Now, let me Let me interject something. 31 days from that phone call is the 15th of June. 30 days from that phone call is the 16th of June when George said she walked out of the house with the baby. Now, did you notice how Casey always talks about a nanny? We all have babysitters. She's got a nanny.
I'm not questioning, because it was very evident to me watching her, looking at her and then reading the things that I did read. It was very, very obvious to me that, you know, if I had to invoke a diagnosis without having assessed her myself, that she's definitely a pathological liar. However, I sincerely question whether or not the accounts that were given by her mother and father, whether they were accurate. And I think everybody wrote on that, because everything is kind of based on what they stated. And we're not sure that that's the actual chain of events. Perhaps an accident did happen. Chloroform. People jumped into this chloroform debate when the guy said that the mom or his little software recorded that they had searched for chloroform 84 times. And I know that you said in your comment and in your opening that, you know, this was the chain of events and she could not afford Xanax and da-da-da. Well, you can go and get Benadryl and give a child 2 Benadryl and knock them out. So you don't
exactly.
need to concoct
Benadryl
a potion.
Is a common use, yes.
Right. So you don't have to concoct a potion of chloroform of all things to make your child go to sleep. There are a host of over-the-counter supplies that will put children to sleep. So
Let me see. You're a doctor. Let me jump in here with this. Listen to the terminology that Casey uses, and it might give you a hint. In other words, you're a doctor. You're trained in that area. She uses a nanny. She doesn't have a babysitter. She talks about using resources. She talks about using other assets in searching for the child. Mm-hmm. She throws in this supposed phone call that afternoon on the 15th.
Right.
She's
right.
a very,
exactly.
very, as you said, very adept liar, but she uses terminology. She does things that are out of the norm.
But that doesn't make her a murderer, though.
But that goes back to her family. Child was missing on June 15th. You don't tell the 911 operator it was 31 days ago. She doesn't need to do the math. You do the math. You tell her what day she went missing.
Right. And
she says it was 31 days ago, the 15th of June.
No, I never heard the 15th of June. I heard 31 days ago. She was very careful to say twice 31 days.
The call was made on the 15th of July.
Well, why do I have to do the math if I'm the 911 operator? You tell me what day your child went missing.
Well, what has happened, they discussed this before they made the 911 call.
Yes, they did.
They did.
Exactly.
They got the calendar. They looked and everything. And then Casey is saying that she spoke with someone the day that this happened or the day before.
Yes.
And the parents, now, when I looked at the case, I figured that family, Casey has been brought up lying. Parents didn't do a whole bunch about her lying.
Mm-hmm.
So now she's an adult, and she tells lies so that those lies appear to be truth to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if she's getting it from parents, her father, or her mother. But I think part of that family's dysfunction was displayed right in that telephone conversation.
Absolutely.
Mother was too overreactive, and daughter was calm. But they had discussed what was going to be said in this 911. And 911, Sam, you're going to have parents that's going to wait 31 days or 30 days or 2 weeks, and your grandchild is gone. I would be trampled streets of doing something if my granddaughter is missing.
But who calls the police and reports the car missing before they report the child missing?
Exactly. And also,
so that if the child is still missing and something awful happens to the child, then you can assume that maybe the car is connected with it and some third party is connected with her injury or missing.
Was that maybe really what was possibly going
to
be supposedly the story, and then some kind of way they got through in a tailspin and that story kind of unraveled. But maybe the car being reported missing, because I guess I'm confused, Mr. Padilla, about the car. The car cannot be missing and Cindy Anthony saying at the same time that she smelled death in the car. Is the car missing?
Okay, watch this. Remember on the 24th when she drove around the corner
and
dumped the body? Okay. Now, she ripped the bag and she got decomposition on herself. That's the clothes that Cindy washed. And she got decomposition in the trunk of the car. That was a horrible smell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she's driving around in the car on the 27th, 2 days later,
mm-hmm.
3 days later. She says to her friend, Amy, "Oh, my dad borrowed the car, ran over some animals, and I got this terrible smell in the car."
Mm.
The same evening, the 27th, on a Friday night, she parks it next to the dumpster at the Amscot and says she ran out of gas, just kind of walks away from it, okay? Just literally walks away from the car. Now, the car got towed on the 30th. Mrs. Sanchez, the manager there, calls on Monday morning. She's seen that car for 3 days parked there. She calls the tow yard. The tow yard comes, tows the car off. Gentleman at the tow yard testified there was the death smell in the car. But here's what happens. The notice gets sent out on the 4th of July, or the 5th of July, I believe, to the Anthonys. They don't use their front door when they come and go. They always click the garage door up, drive into the garage door, lower the door, and go in through the kitchen from the garage.
Okay, Wikipedia says that they found that notice on the 13th.
They found it on the 15th.
Okay, well, okay. Wikipedia.
But that's only because they never use the front door to go in and out of that house. Even when we were there, they would drive in the garage, put the door down behind their vehicle, and walk in the kitchen door. Very seldom did they use the front door, which is where the notice was put, on the front door of the house. On the 15th, George is out there puttering around in the yard, and he sees this thing in the door, and he goes over there and he pulls it. And he's very upset, very aggravated, because it's not the first time he's had to go to a tow yard and recover the car, because she's run out of gas, left it on the side of the freeway or in a neighborhood, and they've towed the car and stored it, and it costs him $200, $300 every time. So he's very aggravated. Why does he take a gas can with him when he goes to the yard? Well, because he knows, he figures he's going to need gas. Now, does he have gas in the can at the time, or does he have to go fill the gas can? I don't know. I forgot what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But when he's there, George has been a homicide detective in Ohio for 10 years, homicide.
Mm-hmm.
He has smelled decomposing bodies.
Mm-hmm.
When he nears the car, he knows that there's decomposition there. Once you smell decomposition, you never, ever forget it. Cindy might not, as well as a nurse should, know decomposition, but George knows there's decomposition. What did he say? "I thought it was either my daughter or my granddaughter, and I was praying that it wasn't either one." When he looks in the trunk and he sees garbage in there, his mind clicks, "Oh, my God, thank you, Lord, it's not my daughter or my granddaughter." They take the car home, but George, in the back of his mind, knows there's decomposition. When the cops come to the house, the cops that walk through the garage where the car is, know there's decomposition.
Okay, remind us again what day this is.
On the 16th.
Of July.
There was cops there the night of the 15th, and there was cops there on the 16th. 16th is when they went on a big tour. They went to the Sawgrass Apartments. They went to where the Gloria, the mother of this babysitter, was supposed to be. They went out to the studios.
Universal.
And finally they got tired of chasing their tail, and they arrested her. Now, the cops were sitting there saying there's decomposition. I mean, there's no way the cops are thinking the child's alive, but there's decomposition in the trunk of the car. They, in their own mind, have got a woman that is lying to them about where their daughter is, and there's decomposition smells. You know, the child's dead. She was in the trunk of the car. They're not going to jump up and say this. They've got a messy case on their hands already, because this young lady is an accomplished liar. When I met her, the very next day after I met her, we were sitting on the couch. We were sitting there talking, just talking about just general things.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that she was lying about things she didn't have to lie about. And I told her, "Casey, when you get through this, and you will get through it, you are going to get through it, you come see me and I'll give you a job in the work I do, because I need accomplished liars." Did she get up and get upset at me or anything? No, she just giggled and looked at me. She says, "For real?" I said, "Yes."
Yeah. Wow. Okay, so, y'all, we got to play catch up. I'm gonna go to the meter reader's dispatch call about the body of Kaylee Anthony. We also want to deal with the timeline, and we got a couple phone calls we got to get to, y'all. But before I do that, if you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight. We're talking about the Kaylee Anthony case. We're talking to a bounty hunter, Leonard Padilla, Fort Worth attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds, and sociology professor Dr. Zoe Spencer. If you're on the phone lines and have a question or a comment, press 1. Or if you're listening in via the Internet, dial us up at 347-850-8390, and again, press 1. A reminder, the chat room is open tonight. So if you have a question or a comment, you can post it up in the chat room. If you would, put it in red so I can see it quickly when I glance into the chat room throughout the night. Also, tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at www.AfricanAmericanNewsAndCommentary.com. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is also being brought to you by Daily Deposits for the Soul, your daily guide to enriching your soul and improving your mind in just 15 minutes a day. They're located on the web at www.DailyDepositsForTheSoul.com. Okay, y'all, let's go to this this dispatch call, or this meter reader's call to his dispatch about what happened with him finding this bag that he thinks is Mr. Here we go.
on your right-hand side, and there's like a big swamp area there, and there. We found a dead 4-foot eastern diamond rattle back there, but that's not really the thing. There's like two little in areas you can go. There's a big long tree laying down, and there's a lot of swamp back in there. Well, back behind one of the trees down there was a coil that's 4-foot eastern diamond rattlesnake. I'm not going in that crap.
Okay, so if you're going on Suburban,
you're heading down towards the school.
Okay, and it's after Chickasaw on the right-hand side?
Yeah, there's the road kind of stops, and then there's like this, you go down, and there's a 6-foot-tall fence on the left-hand side, and then the right-hand side, they're open heading towards the school, and it's all swamp area on both sides. And it would be on the right-hand side that I saw what I saw.
Okay, I'll let them know.
I appreciate you, and I love you. I have no idea what it was, so, and I don't want to waste any more of the county's money, but I'm just telling you I saw something.
Not a problem.
Thank you,
ma'am.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Now, based on what I heard, I wouldn't go out there either.
Now, wait a minute.
Oh.
The rattlesnake was dead on the edge of the road, not in the brush.
I'm sorry. This is part two.
Uh-huh. I called this in yesterday. I don't know if this was what I looked at today or not, but when the road back up, I stopped in the middle of it where there's a swamp. There's a, if you're coming out, there would be a fence on the right-hand side. And just open, you know, swamp area on the left-hand side. I went down, and, well, I had to tell you, I went down, and there, behind one of the trees was a, and it looked rather suspicious. I didn't touch anything. And then a little bit further up, you can tell where someone ran across with a mower, but the weeds are still real high in that area. There's a fallen tree that looked somebody had tried to cut on it at one point. But there was a white board hanging across the tree, and there was something round and white underneath of it. And I don't know what it is, but it just didn't look like something that should be there.
Can I have some cross streets, please?
There is no cross streets. If you turn on Suburban, go down past, you know, the first street, go down past the second street, where the road returns and it goes to their home. If you go all the way down to the end of Suburban, there's a school down there.
Okay, Suburban and where, sir?
So, down to Chickasaw. It's like right by their house, though. You go in off of Chickasaw, you go down Suburban, you'll pass, what is it, Lemberton?
Uh-huh.
That's the first one, and then the second one is Hope Springs, and then if you go all the way down, there's a school there. As you're going down to the school, you're going to hit a wooded area. If you're going towards school on your left-hand side...
What's the name of the school, sir?
It's just the elementary school there. I don't know. I just read the meter at it yesterday. I went for my meter number. I really don't pay attention to that, the rest of it. But if you go down there, there's a swamp on the left-hand side, and there's a fence, about a 6-foot-high fence there. On the other side of the road, there is another swamp right there, and then the area is all right in there. That's also where we found a dead 4-foot eastern diamondback rattlesnake, and that's why I didn't go any further into the swamp.
Okay, Roy, what's your call? I'm going to send this call up. I'm going to take a look for the bag. I also have another phone number that I need you to dial. Is the phone number set up for anything doing with the Kaylee investigation?
Oh, what, the Swiss Army?
Yes, sir.
I really rather would not be a county employee and all that. That's why I'm talking to you.
You can still do it, regardless if you're a county employee. You can remain anonymous.
Probably find a freaking body.
Yeah, sir, you can still remain anonymous if they do find a corpse.
Okay,
because we definitely need you to contact the number because all information is compiled there. And if anything does come up out of it, we'll see who else is also called about it and put it all together.
Okay.
Please do that. Do you have the phone number?
What is it? Go ahead. 1-800-423.
Uh-huh.
Hold on a second.
1-2-3. Yes. Okay, Sheriff's Office, how can I help you?
Yeah, it's Hickenhoek Elementary School.
Okay.
I just, I'm a meter reader with Orange County. I had the Kaylee's route Monday, and there's an area in between where Suburban ends down at Hickenhoek Elementary. There's a swamp area that I saw something that I called in a tip the other day, and they said they would dispatch an officer out to me when I got there. And I'm here.
And exactly where are they going to meet you, on Suburban and West?
I'm not near any of the roads. I'm just in a swampy area that's between where the Anthony's Road starts and the Hidden Oaks. There's no streets here. It's just swamp on either side of the road.
Okay, can you go back to the intersection of Suburban and Hope Spring and wait for them there? Is that the nearest intersecting street to where you are?
Well, yeah, it's only coming around the corner. They can see me sitting here.
Okay, so you're right past Oak Spring.
Right, yeah. I'm sitting facing the road in the opposite direction, and I'm in a blue four-door Cavalier.
All right. I'll have somebody out there as soon as I can.
All right, thank you.
You have a good day, sir.
You too, bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, you all, that was all three calls from the meter reader.
Why were they not brought up in the trial?
That's a good question.
And he sure was curious for them to call and go to that site for to have three calls. And so, Mr. Padilla, you had indicated that they may have been eavesdropping during the conversations of Kaylee while she was in jail.
Talking to her attorney.
Had to figure out a way to discover this body.
Mm.
And so the information is
passed from the eavesdropping officer to another officer who passes it on to Michelle Carpentier, who passes it on to her boyfriend, the meter reader,
who's a meter reader.
Is assigned on the 11th of August to go to that area. But when he goes and looks for the building blocks, which is where the starting point is for the hunt, he is 72 feet off in the distance. The Diamondback was on the edge of the road, which was picked up by David Dean, not him. He didn't have to go out into the bushes. He's talking stuff to get somebody out there to locate this body. Later on when the body was located, if you listen to his call and his testimony, he says the body was in this bag. He kicked the bag, the skull rolled out. Here he's looking at the skull out in the open, he says. He's been told certain things, but listen to this. On the 11th, 12th, and 13th, there is no public outcry about a body. It's a missing person. It's a missing child. Only law enforcement knows the child is dead.
Okay, now this is August 11th, 12th, and 13th.
Correct, August. In other words, at that time, there's no outcry about a dead child. It's a missing child, and the only people that know that the child is dead is Casey, her attorney, and the cops.
And her mother and father and brother.
Not at that time.
And the meter reader.
Not at that time. The meter reader knows, but her brother and the father and the mother do not know on the 11th, 12th, and 13th of August that the child is deceased.
Okay, let's go to the phone line.
They have a good, strong hunch. They have a strong hunch.
Yeah, the strong
hunch. Because of the smell in the car.
Let's go to the phone lines. Area code 415-206. Good evening. You're on center stage. Good evening.
Oh, that's you.
Oh, yes. Hi, that's me. Yes.
Hello.
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 Okay, good evening. You're on center stage.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good. I'm Ruth. And give me my questions, honey. Okay, so, all right. My question is, if I wanted to get to the trial, maybe I'm getting ahead of things.
No, just start out there. Cause
wait a minute. I have another, a more pressing question.
Okay, go ahead.
I got to put this tactfully. Why is, if Mr. Padilla is telling everything right now, doesn't that compromise the ability of Casey to tell everything and make money? And if Mr. Padilla is suing her, isn't he shooting himself in the foot by compromising her ability to make money by telling this story?
Why would he care about her making money?
Well, because he's suing her.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Okay.
Is that a
disrespectful question? The truth in this situation, the truth coming out is more important than any kind of money that anybody could make off of these facts. It's more important.
I mean, there's an outcry caller from the world wanting to know the truth about this. So don't you think it's good that there's a good guy out there who's telling what really happened? I mean, he was on the ground. He met with the family. He talked with Casey. You know, he talked with her mother. He talked with her father. Don't you really want to know from somebody that was on the inside what really happened during those days that they were searching for Kaylee?
Well, this was not all brought up in court, and so, of course, Casey didn't take the stand. The parents did not allude to a lot of things as Mr. Padilla is saying, that they were on the stand, and no lawyers brought out all of that stuff during the trial.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point in time, Mr. Padilla, since your testimony or your version was not actually sworn to in court, I understand that you have some vital facts that were not even introduced in court and could have made the difference on the decision for the jury.
But here's the thing, and the good judge will tell you this. Had Ashton put either myself, Rob, or any of the seven people that were there that had talked to that family day in and day out for 9 days, it might have led to a discussion about how the body was eventually discovered, and did law enforcement overhear a conversation?
Carrie, can I interject? I'll throw that case out. If the prosecutors knew that their investigators and their law enforcement officials conducted an illegal search and they pursued capital case against this girl, then the prosecutors would have violated their oath of office. If that comes out that they are intentionally trying to get a capital case against her and their own investigators that were dirty. And so it's some cover-up that could have been charges brought against them. But that was really, that's not the case here, though.
Why? Why isn't it the case?
Well, because, Mr. Padilla, you know that, but the judge didn't know it. The jurors didn't know it. It didn't come out in testimony.
Right, because they started the case. Remember the first
thing?
If
it had come out that the prosecutors knew that their law enforcement office, if this in fact happened, if they knew that their law enforcement officers eavesdropped or violated their constitutional right to privacy or to conversation between attorney-client in a jail facility, and then, factored a way to discover that body on acquired information, then you will have a big scandal surrounding that case.
Absolutely.
And
but remember where Ashton... Remember where Ashton started the trial? With the call, not from Kronk on the 11th, 12th, and 13th, not from Kronk on the 11th of December, but with dispatch calling 911. The water meter readers dispatch calling 911 is where Ashton started the trial. He didn't start with any one of the seven people that were living with Casey that Casey spoke to very openly, consistently, every day on a daily basis. He didn't start with the calls from Kronk on the 11th, 12th, and 13th, or even Kronk's call in December. He was very deceptive in starting the trial with the call from the dispatcher of the water people to 911. Therefore, staying away from anything that led up to the discovery of the body.
Okay, Dr. Z, you were trying to say something a few minutes ago?
I am about to burst. It is very clear that the dispatcher knew where the body was and knew that there was a body in it, in the brush or whatever. I mean, there are two things. There's an involved reaction, an attached reaction, and then there's a detached reaction. He calls three times, and it's very, very clear that he is trying to herd law enforcement to this area, and then he even makes reference and alludes to, well, what if there's a body? And he also states numerous times, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, but it just doesn't look right to me. So it's very clear that he knows that there's a body. And I don't know if I heard it correctly in the beginning, if he mentioned Anthony or not, but I thought in the first tape he actually started out the conversation by mentioning the case or something. I don't know if I misheard that, but I just
he mentioned their address in that area, that their home was on that street or near the area.
So I definitely think that he knew, and I do agree with Mr. Padillo that someone had to have given him that information. However, Mr. Padillo, and I don't want to, you know, make it a debate because I have my own hypothesis about, you know, the circumstances and, you know, nobody wants to hear it. But ultimately, he said that only Casey, her attorney, and the crew knew what happened to Kaylee. I disagree with that. I really think that her parents were definitely involved. In the 911 call tape between her mom and Casey, you can hear her mother coaching her in the background. And there's something that we call detached affect. in psychosocial terms, and that's when somebody removes themselves from a situation. And Casey is very, very detached in that phone call. However, she is very attached to the 31 days, which I believe, based on that, was the day her daughter died. I definitely disagree that chloroform had anything to do with it. I think all of that has been disproven. You know, the 84 calls turned into or the 84 searches turned into one search, which could have been detrimental to her. And I agree with the judge. I was there too, you know, sideline coaching, and I knew that there was no way possible that the jury, based on the evidence, could have found her, legitimately found her guilty. So, you know, what Mr. Padillo is saying, I respect it. I think that he has some, you know, some other inside information that the public may not have been privy to. But I also think that a large part of his testament and his belief is based on, you know, what the prosecution attempted to build as the case around Casey. And I think that her mom and her father went completely unscathed in this. And I really do believe that there were some things, for example, when they spoke about the shovel and sending Casey next door to get a shovel, the 911 call about the car, the tow truck, all of these things to me seem to be very, very staged. The whole case is staged, but the mother and father definitely played roles in staging the outcome. So how about this hypothesis? How about some accident happened, no matter what it was, whether she drowned or what have you? The parents find her, and the parents are the ones to concoct the scheme to claim that she's missing, because the whole missing person scandal or scheme comes from the parents, not from Casey.
Yeah.
The parents are the ones who initiate the whole scheme. And to me, and from judging her affect, both in the trial and also even in the 911 call, it seems to me that she's almost like a bystander to the way that her daughter's death is going to be managed. So I really more so believe that her death was an accident and it was a cover-up. Something happened, and when the cover-up unraveled, they rolled their daughter under the bus. That's what I believe.
Wow. Okay, y'all, we're going to go back to the phone lines, area code 512. And 415, I'm not sure if you were finished with your question. I'll come back to you. Area code 512, 739. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in and say a couple things. First of all, I'm really happy with what I'm hearing from the doctor. Scary Carrie here, and I also host a Blog Talk radio show. Good job, Carrie. You're doing awesome, and I'm glad to see
you
got this topic going. And I'm even more pleased to see that you have a doctor that, you know, she's getting it. And it sounds like she's done a little bit of research, too. And I've done an extreme amount of research.
On this particular case?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, tell us what you know.
Well, I can't really just lay out what I know because I have 2 months worth of extreme investigating.
Okay.
So, I mean, you could pick any topic and I'll tell you what I know. But one thing I would like to comment on, and first of all, I don't know how to reach this doctor, and I would love it if she would call in and be on my show as well, and you can look that up. It's my hometown. But anyway, we feel that George Anthony was involved.
Send me an email and I'll hook you up with the doctor, but go ahead. You were saying what else?
Yeah, okay, cool. I was saying, you know, it's very clear and very obvious that George Anthony was involved. And from our viewpoint, and, you know, like I said, I've investigated this a lot, so I have a lot of, you know, I don't want to say evidence, but I will say facts, really straight up facts, that show that Casey was indeed at the house on the morning of the 16th. And if you look at the team maps, you'll see.
Okay,
and
we're saying 15th of June, 15th of July, 15th of what?
Of June.
Okay.
Of June. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so from what I can piece together, the only thing that makes absolute sense, and we can go ahead and we can set aside how she died for just a minute, because although it's extremely relevant in terms of understanding his involvement,
Mm-hmm. We can pick it up just a little bit after she died. So let's just say that on the 15th, they were there, and somehow the baby died. Okay, mm-hmm. We don't know if it was an accident. We don't know if it was murder, because that has not, absolutely has not been proven.
Right.
But we do know she died. We know that the 15th is the last day that, you know, anybody spoke or saw
right.
Haley. So let's say she died. She died that morning, you know, mm-hmm. somewhere in around before 2, because that is when you're going to see a gap in any kind of activity at all, whether it's the laptop, the desktop, the phone, texting, whatever. And this is very unusual behavior for Casey. And then next thing you know, the way I see it is, Cindy was not dead. And mm-hmm. when
the child died, Cindy was not home.
Correct.
Okay.
Cindy was not home on the 16th. Now, I don't know, Carrie, if you've been able to hear the radio interview that Dana did the next morning after the verdict. This is a second cousin of Cindy Anthony. She lives in Houston. And she had called in to a radio station in Houston. I've got the link, and I can send that to you later. But she called in, and she had said, and I believe this 100%, and I have a lot of supporting followers that feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that until the night before, and of course she was speaking of the night of the verdict, because this would have been the next day. She says, until the last night, we believed, and she stressed that she was calling for Cindy Anthony's side of the family and not George.
Mm-hmm.
She said that prior to this phone call that she received, and she didn't say who called her, but I'm thinking it was Cindy,
mm-hmm.
They believed that Casey was, you know, guilty, and they did not support her. And then, after these phone calls, she was emphatic that they believed that everything Jose Baez said in his opening statement was true. Now, mm-hmm. I'm not going to take it that far, but I will go as far as to believe what I've seen proven. Now, with all that said, the way that I feel is, if that's the case, then after Haley had died, that would have meant, because this woman said that when Haley died, when George walked out, Jose Baez's opening statement was that George came around, the baby was limp in his arms. And at that moment, Casey fell to the ground and began to cry hysterically over and over and was inconsolable. The cousin Dana had said that the phone calls that she had confirmed that when she had collapsed like that, that it was an utter mental breakdown beyond something that she would ever recover from. So if you believe that, then you could believe that, you know, maybe she was literally inconsolable, maybe in a fetal position, say, for 2 or 3 hours. Now, during that time, I believe that George Anthony made the decision to bag up her body. All right.
Okay. Let me tell you, because we're going to have to move on in a second. But are you saying that you're saying that Dad and Casey were home at the time that Kaylee died?
Yes.
And so you believe Casey and her father came up with this idea of what they needed to do in order to cover this up?
No, I'm saying George came up with it while Casey was inconsolable and he couldn't even communicate with her.
If George is a police officer and had been a detective, then he had to know that there's cases in which people die accidentally. So why would he say the child did not
really
die accidentally do it this way? That doesn't make sense.
You know what?
Can I answer?
Yeah. Go ahead, Doctor.
Can I answer that? You know, looking at their family dynamics, you know, the family, their family dynamics, and the judge alluded to it, their family dynamics are awful. And, you know, I was able to catch the part of the trial where their family was testifying, where George was testifying, Cindy was testifying, and then I read about the brother's testimony. Their family is dysfunctional. So, as an example, if something happens at their home, say Haley drowned in the pool, as is the speculation.
Mm-hmm.
They find her in the pool. There's a level of stigma that's attached to that neglect. Even if it's an accident, there's a level of stigma that's attached to the fact that a child dies on your watch.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a level of ego discomfort that comes with that. And if you're concerned about your image and your family's image, then you're not always in, and, you know, we kind of talked about this. You know, we're talking as people with normal consciences and ability to process things normally. But when you have a family, and when they talked about her mother and her pregnancy and how her mom was in denial about the pregnancy, you know, these are things that, that pose the threat of threatening your status. So if you're not balanced, you know, admitting and dealing with the ego discomfort and is really deep of knowing that someone that you love died on your watch can force you into creating a situation where you move from being one type of victim to another type of victim. And I completely agree with the caller. I know that, you know, Casey, from what I've seen, I don't know her, but I definitely think that she has issues with lying. Do I think that she was a willing accomplice in the cover-up to her, her daughter's accident? Absolutely not. The dynamic also of a father and a mother so actively and willingly and hostily disengaging from their daughter and accusing their daughter of murder without any kind of empathy for her whatsoever, that's problematic. That's dysfunctional. You know,
but one thing that I found in research, it says that the Anthony's computer showed searches including neck breaking.
Let me tell you what that was about.
Okay.
Casey Anthony. Let me go back a little further than that. When Cindy was living in Ohio and she met this charming police officer who was on the county sheriff's office, Cindy was living, you might say, on the wrong side of the tracks, even though she was a nurse. This officer was married. He ended up in the hospital. She was caring for him. His family was fairly well-to-do. They owned several new car agencies in the area. They hooked up. They got married. They had a couple children. But still, there was a problem. She wasn't accepted on that side of the tracks. They moved to Florida. In Florida, she became, after she took the wheels off her house, very respectable. She worked at a medical center. He had retired and gotten himself a job at some security offices. And inside that house was a Leave It to Beaver residence. I have never met a more spotless, more clean, more everything in its place house, and I've been in houses a million times.
Really?
She was always on the right side of everything in that house. The dogs were even coiffed properly. Everything was perfect. When her daughter didn't graduate from high school, she had a graduation party. You're right. If you talk to Rick, she denied 7 months pregnancy. No, she's retaining water. When we got there, everything was told to us, and we told them, that's fine. You tell us anything you want, but we're going to check ourselves to make sure. We're going to verify.
Well, what does that have to do with neck breaking?
Okay, getting to the neck breaking thing. Casey comes up with a story and tells Amy, my parents are getting a divorce. This was right before the child disappeared. They're getting a divorce, and mother says, I can take over the payments on the house. Now, she doesn't even have a job, but she's telling Amy that she's going to take over the payments on the house. Remember when Judge Perry said something to the effect he quipped? Hey, she probably was thinking of killing her parents? He couldn't have been closer to the truth. Casey was going to kill her parents and end up with the house. In Casey's own mind, the way she operates and the way she thinks, that was a natural scheme. She killed the parents. All she has to do is step in and take over the payments. In order to take over the payments, she then needs a roommate that will help make some of the rent payment, make it a house payment.
That is crazy.
Let me interject, because
Perry himself said it on the bench.
That's crazy.
But wow. When I was listening to this and looking at the family, we usually think of mental illness as a taboo. I think that there should have been some treatment for mental illness product for each of those family members. Casey has been suffering, has never been treated, or if she has, the parents have denied, in denial. And so all of this stems from, there's a great issue of mental illness among all of them that were in that family, and particularly even the brother who addressed the fact that when his little sister was pregnant, he felt like he was abandoned by his parents because they were giving her paying attention to her. But the mental illness that Casey has gone through demonstrates her actions as an adult. And if she doesn't feel the empathy and sincereness and when death and act like a normal person, that's because in our household she's been treated like that and they have been taught to suppress those feelings, and I don't know, the doctor probably will have the proper term for it, but you can see that. I can see that.
I asked the doctor what she feels at.
And now what she's going to have to deal with is being acquitted. So we have the stress and the pressures of the media, the negativity, the lot of dislike. Is she going to be able to have enough self-confidence, enough self-esteem to overcome this, or is she going into a great depressive mode and doing something that's bad to herself?
Let me see if I can explain.
I don't think she's giving interviews that's going to highlight some of the things that you said, Mr. Padilla, because she is not going to be telling the truth.
No, she's not. She never.
Carrie,
Let me tell you. Can I
interject, though? I'm sorry, Mr. Padilla. I don't want to. I just got to get this in. I don't even know the young lady, but, you know, I don't know why I have a level of empathy for her, but I guess it's because, you know, I'm with Baez, and I really do not believe that she murdered her child.
In her mind, she didn't. It was an accident.
No, I'm saying to you, Mr. Padillo, that I do not believe that Casey Anthony murdered her daughter, period. I do not believe that happened. I strongly believe, even based on, you know, and the judges is more of this than me. I'm an analyst, but I'm not an attorney. I believe that, like, in many cases, there was a rush to put the pieces of Kaylee's death together because nobody was going to tell the truth. I believe that it was an accident. I believe that she drowned in the pool. And even what you said about the home, that solidifies it for me. Because everything that you said about how meticulous they keep things and where they came from, you're talking about developing an image that you need to protect. And when you develop that image so much so that you're in denial about your daughter's pregnancy, or you're in denial about a divorce, or you're in denial about your family dysfunction and you don't want to seek, or you're in denial about your daughter's failure to complete high school, an accident happens. That type of dynamic is just the dynamic that you need to facilitate making something up instead of following the normal course of action to call 911 and say there's been an accident in our house, our granddaughter has drowned in our pool, da-da-da, because you don't want to deal with that stigma. And so I strongly believe that the accident happened, and I believe that George and Cindy got together and they concocted this story and they forced Casey to take on this role of perpetuating her daughter being missing. And in the 911 call, you can tell that she is very, very detached from that call. She's very, very detached from what's going on. She has her mother in the background coaching her, but she's very detached about everything except for that 31 days that she knows was the day of her daughter's death. Stuff happened, hurricanes happened, the story began to unfold. George and Cindy had made it up. They got scared that everything was going to be opened up. And instead of coming clean, they decided that they were going to scapegoat their own daughter, and that's the psychosocial term, scapegoat their own daughter in order to protect their own image. And once she lawyered up, they knew that she was not going to take the stand. She was not going to be able to tell the truth and say what happened, because it would not only implicate her parents, but it would implicate her further as well. And so they rolled her under the bus. And, you know, she may be a liar. I definitely think she has issues. But, you know, I think as humans, kind of, we got to start looking at the reality that just because you have mental health issues and you've been brought up in a dysfunctional family doesn't mean that you're automatically predisposed to being a murderer, especially of your own child.
Okay, speaking of dysfunction, was she molested, Mr. Padilla? Was she molested by her father and her brother, as the defense attorney, Mr. Baez, said?
In my opinion, George did not molest her ever. Did her brother touch her in a brother-sister doctor scene? I don't know. I never went into that. The first time I heard about both of those things was basically a pre-trial, when there were statements that she had made to other people in the jail. in me and knowing George and meeting George, he was a cop. Now, one of the things that a lot of people poke at is the fact as to when he was on the stand. You have to understand that law enforcement officers were people off the street that were looking for a job when they became cops.
Hmm.
They're not super intelligent. They're not super anything. They just happen to have a badge and a gun.
Hmm.
They do not like to be quizzed. They're the ones that do the asking of questions. They don't like to have questions asked.
Hmm.
They're the ones that do the prodding of a fugitive. They're the ones that do the prodding of a suspect. They do not like to be put on the stand.
Oh.
George's testimony was always suspect when we used to talk to him. And we used to say, George, quit being a cop today. Come on. Just be a dad. Be a grandpa. Talk to us like a grandpa. Tell us what you used to do on a daily basis with your granddaughter. And then we'd go out to the neighborhood and check it. Tell us, George, how did you feel? How did you feel when it was announced that a body had been found?
Mm.
Talk to us, George, about the real things in life. Don't talk to me like a cop. I've been around a million cops. I don't want to hear your answers as a cop. I want to hear them as a grandfather. I want to hear them as a father.
Could he do it?
Yes.
Tell me about the tattoo. There was a tattoo that she got, it appears like on...
July the 4th.
July the 4th. What was
Third.
The tattoo about? If she didn't do this, if it was a situation in which, it was an accident, why the tattoo?
She showed the tattoo to Casey about the second day that we were there with her.
You mean showed it to Tracy?
To Tracy. Casey showed it to Tracy. She says, I got this, now watch this, I got this in memory of my daughter.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
The second day we were there, there was no...
If the daughter's not dead, what does she mean in memory of her daughter? Because at that point, you all are still searching for what y'all believe to be Kaylee still alive.
Yes, exactly.
Well,
up until the 27th of August, we believe...
Say what?
We believe on the 27th, up until the 27th of August, we really sincerely believe the child was alive. The 27th of August is when everything went down the tubes for us, when the law enforcement announced there was decomposition of human decomposition in the trunk of the car. I can get around to human decomposition. Somebody can go to a morgue, get a body, stick it in there for a couple of days, you've got human decomposition. But they also announced a hair with a death band that can only be one of the females in the family. I told Cindy, I can get around decomposition. I cannot get around the hair with a death band. There's one other thing that was never brought up in the trial.
Okay.
At that time, law enforcement said there was 2.6 days of decomposition in the trunk of the car.
Mm-hmm. What does 2.6 mean?
They couldn't understand the 2.6 days of decomposition in the trunk of the car.
Mm.
That didn't fit into their testimony timeline. Therefore, they just didn't talk about it. You go back and listen to those announcements as to the 27th of August.
Okay. I promise you, we're under 30 minutes left in this show.
Are you writing the book, or are you going to be paid for your version of what happened? No, I just asked the question though, because
you're talking to Mr. Padilla. Mr. Padilla, you're talking to you.
No. Listen, I've been involved in hundreds of cases like this. And one thing I learned, if the child is found alive or if the person is found alive, oh, yeah, I'll talk about it and I'll read about it and I will take fees. But
mm-hmm.
when the person is dead or the child is dead, I will not accept anything. The only thing I've accepted in this particular situation or myself or any of the people is we've accepted a couple of flights when we definitely did not want to go to New York. We did not want to go, and they said, well, we'll pay for your flight. And it wasn't even the payment of the flight. It was Judge Jeannie Piero that I really, really, I mean, if she asked me to do something, yeah, I'll do it, you know.
So you're talking about interviews about the case.
Yeah, exactly. In other words, for the judge, I'll do it. When she asked if I'd go out to Orlando on a Wednesday morning, I flew to Orlando. I had to be in Los Angeles that afternoon. I flew to Los Angeles. I had to be in Sacramento that evening. It damn near killed me. But for her, yes, I will walk on water.
Wow.
No doubt about it.
Love that. Okay, now listen to the real quick. If you just tuned in and you come...
certain things, did the prosecutors...
I say what?
Did the prosecutors ever tell you not to discuss certain things in the media? Mr. Padilla?
No, okay. Absolutely not.
Have they contacted you since the trial?
No. Prosecutors never contacted us. Oh, let me preface this. Prosecutors never contacted me.
never talked to me. Now, as far as a couple of the other people that were with me, like my nephew Tony, who posted
yes.
the bond, I think he basically was in contact with him on several occasions. I think Rob Dick might have been in contact with him on several occasions. I myself was never contacted by the prosecution. I was hassled by law enforcement several times for statements I made, and I told them the more you hassle me, the more I'll continue to make the statement, basically about Kronk and his involvement and his girlfriend working at the jail. Now, subsequently, on August the 30th, I think she was transferred to Human Resources because the cops kept telling me, well, she doesn't even work in the jail. When I went back and checked, I said, yeah, she worked in the jail until August the 30th when you guys transferred her across the street. And then their thing was, how'd you find out? How do you know?
Because that's what you do.
Carrie.
That's what I do.
Okay. Yes,
Carrie, before you move on real quick, I wanted to go back to the tattoo real fast because
okay.
I think that there are a lot of misconceptions about the tattoo, and I want to offer a counter-argument.
See, the
you
tattoo
know, again,
says Bella Vita, which
absolutely.
Is an Italian phrase that means beautiful life.
A beautiful life, absolutely. And like I said, I believe that Casey knew that her daughter was dead because her daughter died 31 days from that phone call, as she stated. That was, you know, that could also be her way of grieving. Her daughter to her was a beautiful life. She knew that her daughter, I believe that she knew that her daughter was dead, but she was forced into this cover-up with her father. She couldn't talk about it. You know, she had to follow the rules, and, you know, there were probably some threats that went along with that in my personal amateur sideline opinion. Mm-hmm. And in memory of her beautiful daughter, she got a tattoo that said a beautiful life to represent what Kaylee meant to her. So, you know, there's always a counter-argument and an antithesis for everything, and I can understand, you know, on a regular level, I can really understand the significance of that tattoo to her, given the situation with her daughter.
Okay.
Now,
oh,
the
well.
Other thing, Doctor, is that we are just assuming from what the witness, at least the lady said, that Casey got it and said, it is in remembrance of my daughter.
True.
Well,
true.
Not the statement. Casey could have gotten it. She's young. People get tattoos.
Absolutely.
This was a tattoo that went. So, you know, it may be that she just, in her world at that time, that was the type of tattoo she wanted, and it
absolutely.
Could have been for her beautiful life.
And
not in memory
yes,
of her daughter, but, of course, we have different versions of that. That's why
absolutely.
A lot of times you just have to listen. You really can't take everything as fact that you hear. And then when people relay it, they may change a word, and that changes
absolutely.
The whole content of
okay, okay, y'all, we're going to go into this timeline for real, because I've been promising this timeline. If you just tuned in, you come Center Stage tonight. We're talking about the Casey Anthony file. We're talking to bounty hunter Leonard Padilla, attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds, and sociology professor Dr. Zoe Spencer. Okay, y'all, let's start with June 15th. June 15th is when they say Kaylee was last seen alive by Cindy Anthony. Supposedly she had taken her to her father's retirement home to see the father. It appears on June 21st, Casey Anthony made an entry into her diary in which she said, I haven't been this happy. Then it appears that on June 30th, Casey's car was towed and was taken to this tow yard. And then it seems like on July 2nd, and I'm trying to move quickly through this, that's when she got the tattoo, the Bella Vita tattoo that, you know, like I said, an Italian saying that means beautiful life. Then it appears on July 12th, 2008, is when George and Cindy said they confronted Casey about why they hadn't seen Kaylee for some time. July 15th is when the car was picked up by George Anthony. That's also the day that they reported Kaylee missing. But we listened to the 911 tape. We heard they initially called and said the car is missing and just kind of, you know, off the cuff said, hey, and by the way, you know, my granddaughter's missing too. And there's a smell in the car that looks like somebody died in it. Okay, and then on the 17th of July 2008 is when Casey Anthony was arrested. Police, you know, they said had taken her to the studios where she said she worked. They taken a tour with her and said, take us to your office. And she kind of took them around in a circle for a while before she said, hey, By the way, I don't work here anymore. I used to work here a long time ago. So then they charged her with child neglect, lying to an investigator, and interfering with a criminal investigation. And she was denied bond at that time. The 21st of July, that's when someone posted a reward for $150,000 if someone found Kaylee Anthony alive. August 5th is when formal charges were filed against Casey Anthony. August 8th, Casey refused to see her brother. So what's going on at this point, Mr. Padilla? And we want you to come back to that as soon as I give this timeline. August 8th, she starts not wanting to have contact with her family. She refused contact with her brother on August 8th. On August 10th, she refused to see her parents. Now this is August 10th. August 8th, she's refusing contact with her family. August 12th is when George said that he believed Kaylee had been kidnapped and kidnappers were being watched. Why did he tell that lie, Mr. Padilla? We're going to want you to address that. August 17th is when you, Mr. Padilla, arrived in Orlando, Florida. So maybe you can pick up from there what happened. But you arrive, all these things have occurred. What is the mood? What is the atmosphere of Orlando, Florida when you hit the ground?
Well, when we hit the ground, there were six of us.
Mm-hmm.
There was only three of us that actually two of us that stood out for the crowd, for the media, Tracy, Tony, Toby, Miguel, and Huizinga.
Okay, let's go back over. Tracy is the person who stayed with Casey for 9 days.
In the room with her for the 9 days, yeah, 24/7.
When she was bonded out of jail.
Tony Padilla, yeah, Tony Padilla was the bail agent who got her out. He's my nephew. They skirted off to the side. The other three individuals that were with us also skirted off to the other side, leaving me and Rob to deal with the media.
Okay.
That night, we then went to the Anthony home. They were having a vigil. We met Lee. I asked Lee, I introduced myself, having previously talked to Baez half a dozen times on the phone, to get the approval of the family to bail her out and to get her approval to bail out, to find out if the family had it okay if we put her in a safe house. They said no, they want her to come home. Okay. So we go, we talk to the family. We have a meeting that night for about 4 hours, from about 10 p.m. to 2 a.m.
Let me jump in. You think when you hit the ground, you're looking for a missing child?
Correct.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, that's what Baez has basically said. And that night, we meet with them, and they say Jesse Grund, who was in love with their daughter, who had lived with the daughter, who knew the baby, who at first thought it was his baby, took a paternity test, turned out it wasn't his baby, but he didn't care. He loved that child. The next day, we go to Baez's office. He reinforces that with a birthday card saying, I love you, two women in my life, the child, the mother. So we're like, okay, this guy probably took the kid and hit her somewhere.
This is Baez, the attorney?
The attorney, Baez, yes, he influenced us to think that Jesse Grund had something to do with kidnapping the child.
Okay.
Now, we're not focusing on a nanny, the kidnapper type thing.
So you never believe that?
We're focusing on Jesse Grund the next day after we're in town.
So the meter reader has already called into the police that he's seen something, and you all think he's a suspect?
We don't even know about the meter reader at that time. We've not even heard about the meter reader.
Okay, okay, go ahead. Okay, Jesse, I'm sorry, Jesse, who then? I'm thinking you're meeting Mr. Kronk. You're not talking about the, I'm thinking you're talking about Roy Kronk.
No,
who are you talking about?
No. Jesse Grund is the old boyfriend.
Gotcha, okay, I'm sorry. Okay.
Who used to be a cop.
Okay.
Anyhow, so we're talking about Jesse Grund. Immediately, I sent my people out into the neighborhood. I want you to talk to everybody, every resident. I want to know what George's attitude was with his granddaughter. 50 people came back with, oh, yeah, I saw him. He was always pulling her in the little red wagon around the neighborhood, just, you know, walking around. She had a little red wagon. She'd pull her in the red wagon. How does he get along with his wife? I've heard stories. He had an affair. She had an affair. She ran him off. Finally, they got back together after they both settled down on their tit-for-tat affairs. What about the daughter? The daughter's in and out. She supposedly works at Universal or somewhere. We don't know. She's always gone. She's always back. What about Lee? Well, Lee moved out a while back. He now lives with a girlfriend. He's not here anymore. He works for some outfit that rents parking lots for big sporting affairs.
Well, let me jump in right here. One thing that sticks out to me, when you hit the ground, it's 2 months later. the first day of the 911 call, they said that the body, the car smelled like someone had been decomposing in the car. So
well,
why is it that you all hit the ground looking for a missing person when in fact the
first
911
said? One of the first things we asked George and his wife, and they both said, no, there was rotting pizza in there, et cetera, and we had confirmed that on one of the nights there was 3 calls to pizza parlors. And we'd already looked at the pictures of the stuff that was in the trunk of the car, and, yeah, there was a ton of garbage in there. My assumption at the time was, okay, George knows the difference between decomposition and rotting garbage. Now, I had not heard his statement regarding him saying that there was decomposition in the trunk. The only thing I'd heard at that point was him telling me, oh, no, I was a homicide cop. I know the difference. It was rotting garbage. Cindy, oh, I'm a nurse. I know the difference. It was rotting garbage. Okay, fair enough. We're okay there so far. A couple days we spent with Baez. He's telling us Jesse Grund's a prime suspect. The family's telling us. We finally get a hold of Jesse Grund, his dad. Now we're perplexed because this guy didn't kidnap anybody. He loved that child. You couldn't talk to him about that child. He broke down crying. Is he a big fake? Has he really got us suckered in? No.
Okay, Jesse Grund is the boyfriend. One thing that no one ever established during this whole trial, and y'all, this is the number one question that has always been on my mind, where is the baby daddy?
Nobody knows. Not even she knows.
Oh, yo. Oh, my
God. She don't even know.
So nowhere in this whole thing did anybody establish who the baby daddy was?
Nope, she don't know. She threw out to us 10 different guys, 10 different possibilities.
Wow.
But she never once said who the baby was. 10 different possibilities she threw at us. I'll tell you why. Because there was times when she was capable of having sex 3 times a day with 3 different guys and never thinking about it. It was just in her nature and wanted adulation so bad that, hey, here I am, come get me.
So that, no one ever came forward during this whole trial and said, that could have been my child.
No, I've had a lot of calls from people saying, I think my son was the father, I think my grandson was the father, but nobody, and I've suggested, hey, go take a DNA test. The cops have DNA from the family. They can match it up. To this day, nobody has come forward and said, here it is, proof positive.
Terry, yeah. I want to jump in real quick because promiscuity is one of the indicators of sexual abuse. So when you ask, was she molested by her father? I mean, it's not the end all to be all, but promiscuity is one of the principal indicators of being abused as a child. So I do want to point
correct.
That out, and that's
not my
opinion.
That. I'm totally aware of that. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Patel,
Carrie, real quick, can I offer my own timeline?
Yeah, go ahead. Why not?
This is my opinion. This is my chain of events. June the 15th, I believe Kaylee drowns. I believe that they wrap her body and bury her body in the backyard.
Now, Mr. Patel, tell me why that couldn't have happened.
Let me finish first because I'm going to run down real quick. Just a counter argument. I believe that they bury her in the backyard. I believe that the weather conditions force her body up. They're then in a position where they have to take her body that's now undergone some level of decomposition, and they have to move her body from their backyard. So they wrap her up in whatever, and they duct tape whatever they wrap her up in, and they take her body to the location where her body was found.
Let me ask you this.
At that point,
Let me ask you this. Does Cindy Anthony know that this is all going on?
Yes. I believe that they make the 911 call. At the point where they make the 911 call is the point where they've moved their body because now they have to get ready to cover their tracks. In the meantime, I believe that Casey is unable to keep up with the lies to keep the police off of her. So the lies catch up. She gets arrested. I think that at the point of August the 8th and the 10th, when she refuses to see her brother and her parents, I think that she's pissed because now everything is coming to pass, and everybody is looking at her, and I think now she's really angry, and I think that she makes a threat that if they don't fix it, because remember, in the 911 call, the original one in July, the mother implicates her daughter at that point. Then all of a sudden on August the 12th, they act like it's a kidnapping. So I think that she makes the threat that if you all don't fix this, I'm going to tell. And so the father comes behind on August the 12th and then implements this investigation and then makes the assumption that it's a kidnapping. And when everything begins to unravel because she's already up under the bus and because she has a problem with lying and her character isn't such that the American population and people can, you know, believe that, you know, she could possibly be a good person or whatever, they decide to leave her and use her as a scapegoat. That's my timeline.
Mr. Padilla, is there anything wrong with her timeline?
Well, here's the situation. On the morning after we got her out of jail, she slept on the floor on a mattress in the bedroom with Cindy and George in their bedroom, master bedroom. There was a ruckus at about 7:15 a.m., at which time George is screaming at her. Casey, tell me what happened to my granddaughter. You know what happened to my granddaughter. Please, don't leave it like this. Tell me. Casey backs out of the room and says, don't talk to me like a scumbag cop. Talk to me like a father for once in your life. Tracy grabs her up and takes her to the other bedroom. His friend from Ohio, who was a cop with him up there for many years and is now retired, George looks at him and he says, Jim, the answer is in that room as to what happened to my granddaughter. Tears are streaming down this man's eyes.
For show.
I asked Tracy, do you think it was an act? She says, I don't like George at all. She don't like him.
Really?
Tracy does not like George.
Because your employee does not like the father, George Anthony.
No.
Okay.
But she says it was not an act.
So she believes what he was saying that morning, he was sincere?
Yes.
Wow. Okay, now one thing you told me that was the 2 days had passed by after you bailed her out of jail, and she didn't say a word about Kaylee. Is that because she was lawyered up and the lawyer told her not to do anything? I mean, was she not showing any signs of, like, you know, concern about Kaylee?
The night that we bailed her out, my nephew had some paperwork to fill out on the bond. Him and her and Tracy went into the kitchen. She fixed salmon patties. She fixed brownies.
Wow.
We were sitting in the living room, myself, George, Cindy, Lee, Rob. She brought us out brownies. Glass of milk, as if nothing had happened. Never mentioning Kaylee, never saying a word about Kaylee. The next day, basically the same thing. The third day, Cindy says she wants to talk to you. She came out, and I says, hey, how's it going, you know? And we chatted about several things in general, things that she just tended to lie about but didn't have anything to do with Kaylee. And that's when I told her, hey, when you get through this, and you're going to get through this, you come see me. I need people that can lie as well as you can, and I'll give you a job. And she looked at me, she says, oh, okay.
Let me
then
ask you a question.
She went into the babysitter Zenaida Gonzalez story, having took her daughter. By that time, we'd already checked out the Zenaida thing, Jay Blanchard and the whole thing. And I told her, look, I didn't come 3,000 miles and leave my chihuahua behind to listen to this BS. I basically had elected to become the bad guy in the act.
Okay, let me ask you, why is it that she was never engaged in the search? Is it because she was on an electronic monitoring system so she couldn't leave the house?
Nope. Like Tracy says, why go search for somebody if you know they're dead?
So she never said, I want to go search for Kaylee?
Never once.
Wow.
Never mentioned her name except a couple times when they were looking at a scrapbook one time of Kaylee. And she says, Tracy, look at my scrapbook. I'm just as pretty as she was.
Wow. And was that raising any red flags for you all as you're sitting and listening to these things and watching the atmosphere in this particular house? Was it, like, clear to y'all, okay, we made this trip down here thinking we're looking for a missing person when actually we're looking for a dead body?
Ma'am, when I make a mistake, it's usually a pretty good-sized one. And at the time of the 27th, when they announced decomposition, I sat there for a good hour, and Rob Dick says to me, have you come up with an exit strategy? And for 2 days, I'm like, what do I do?
Now, was the exit strategy for the media, or was the exit strategy for the family and the defense attorney? What was the exit strategy for? I would have just found it here.
How do we extract from this situation and admit we screwed up?
Okay.
We jumped the gun. We should have waited.
Wow. So, and I understand you're possibly going to sue Casey Anthony down the road. What am I understanding that's happening with you and Baez? Is Baez saying that, well, we didn't tell Padilla to get involved, Padilla kind of came down on his own, he and EquiSearch, or what is he trying to say exactly?
Baez is saying that we basically, I contacted him,
mm-hmm.
and I said, hey, guy, I understand. And I did this because I had discussed it with some media people up in New York, and they were following the case, and it's people that I've dealt with on other cases, other missing children cases. I would say that half the cases we get involved in about missing children, law enforcement announces the child's probably dead, and half of them we found the child alive. The other half, they were right. But anyhow, I've discussed it with him half a dozen times. He's on his way to New York. He calls me from New York. I'm saying, okay, check with the family. The family's got no money. Don't worry about it. I'll pay the fee. Then it's like, okay, fine. Come on back here. Do your thing. We get back there. We do our thing. Now, by this time, Baez knows the child is dead.
Mm.
Regardless of how the child got there, he knows because she has laid the story on him about the drowning in the pool, which I want to tell somebody here that came up with that. That was our original thought, that she drowned in the pool and the family was covering.
That was done.
The day after the decomposition thing came up, we figured, wow, there it is. Problem. The law enforcement people originally took filters out of the pool, and a lot of, in other words, they took a lot of this stuff to test. One of the things I asked the FBI, did you test the water in the pool? Decomposition starts within 4 minutes of death.
Wow.
Had the body been in the pool any amount of time, decomposition would have shown up in the water, unless they had drained the water in the meantime. The answer to me by the FBI guy was, yeah, we tested the water, no decomposition. We thought maybe even so far as to she accidentally killed the child, put her in the pool to make it look like a drowning. It didn't work. She laid her on the grass. That's why the dogs got the hits on the grass.
Yeah, but there's a level. No. In a big pool, there's a level of decomposition that has to occur in order for it to be measurable. And 4 minutes does not emit the level of decomposition that they would be able to adequately measure in a large pool. I mean, that would have to take time. So if they found her
body within an hour.
Okay. And then also I wanted to ask you, Mr. Padillo, you know, everybody is like George is the hero or, you know, he's the victim, but then you're still talking about 31 days. What grandfather loves their grandchild so much, and then you haven't seen them in the 31 days, and you don't even think to make a phone call to your police buddies that you know would help you to look for your daughter and your granddaughter? You know, we have to also understand, where do 911 calls from Casey Anthony's family during the 31 days that they proclaimed that she was missing?
Here's the thing. George and Cindy were having so many problems between themselves. He was having problems with his new job. She was having problems with his affair. He was having problems with her tit-for-tat affair. They were having these, every time that they asked her, and if you go back and you can fill in all 31 days, she's with the babysitter at the beach. She's down in Tampa because the babysitter had a car wreck, and I had to go down there because she was in the hospital. Oh, she went to an outing. You go back and just concentrate on the stories that she told law enforcement, that she told her parents, and the parents related to law enforcement. It fills in all 31 days she had stories for where that child was. The parents were so embroiled in their own mess, their own life falling apart, that whatever she gave them as an excuse, they were willing to readily accept. Now, around the 4th of July,
But that's assuming that the stories that she gave to the police to support the story that the parents came up with was actually what she told her parents, because that doesn't mean just because she gave that as an account to the police does not mean that that's what she was actually telling her parents.
Well, if you go back and look at some of the things she told the cops.
Where is the concrete evidence that shows that she was actually away from the home for those 31 days?
Okay, y'all, listen. We got 90 seconds left. Wow.
Her cell phone.
Wow.
And fortunate individuals around her within that 31 days. I mean, did the parents really have a...
to find it.
Fox documented every phone call she
made
and every tower it bounced off of.
Okay, y'all, we got to get out of here. Listen, we appreciate James Center Stage with us tonight as we talk about this Casey Anthony file with bounty hunter Leonard Padilla, attorney and judge Bobby Edwards, sociology professor Dr. Zoe Spencer. I thank you all for being my guest tonight. I really enjoyed the discussion. A reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or the host. I'm hoping that this conversation tonight maybe open the eyes of somebody who was clueless as to what happened. Maybe we gave you a timeline. Maybe we let you hear a 911 tape or something that maybe helped give you some closure on this particular case. Again, thank you to my guests. Thank you so much for listening. Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much and good night.
Thank you.
Good night.